Hi there. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, back after a week of vacation. And thanks to Marva Hinton for filling in very nicely last week for me. Our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local and regional news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And they are. On my left on your radio dial is Patricia Mazzei, who is done a fantastic job as one of the lead politics reporters who covers Miami-Dade County for the Miami Herald and many other things. Patty, welcome back.
Thanks, Phil.
Brian Bandel is one of the senior business writers at the South Florida Business Journal, always with a lot of important information about the South Florida economy, and we'll be talking about that as well. Brian, welcome back to you.
Thanks. Thanks very much for having me back. I'm also an author with Silverleaf Books.
And Alfred Spellman is with Raconteur Films. He is one half of the team of documentary filmmakers here in South Florida. Billy Corbin is his partner, and there may be a few other partners in there we're missing, but he's working on his latest documentary film we were just talking about, and of course, keeping up with the world on Twitter and elsewhere. Alfred, we welcome you back.
Thanks, Phil. Good to be back with you.
So we're going to start, though, the show off by going to the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald to discuss the big story of the week, and joining us now is Juan Tamayo. Now, one of the Cuba's most renowned dissidents captivated Miami this week and called for unity after 5 decades of a revolution that has divided families. And we heard from blogger Yoani Sanchez, who spoke in front of a crowd at the iconic Freedom Tower. She was also at the Miami Herald and made the media rounds as well. Of course, at the Freedom Tower, very symbolic, where fleeing Cubans were once processed in the 1960s. Sanchez said in Spanish that Cubans who fled to Miami and those who remained on the island are the same people.
De ustedes y de nosotros. En fin, de nosotros, ¿no? Se titula precisamente Cubanos y punto. Y dice así.
So, Juan Tamayo at our studios at the Miami Herald, why is Yoani Sanchez such an important figure, and what mark did she leave here in Miami this week?
Well, you know, Yoani has become the sort of the spokesperson, the most well-known and most highly regarded sort of critic of the Cuban government. She has a knack for saying things that really sort of not only carry the message, but carry it very simply and yet very strongly. She is a philologist, meaning she's works with words, and she really knows how to use them and how to wield them in a very sort of powerful and cutting yet very elegant way. The impact in terms of what she did in Miami was that, you know, she met with just about every single group exile group in Miami. And her message, which tends to be sort of, I would call it moderately, I'm not sure that's the right word, but she managed to sort of get the exile community behind her. There were, of course, some criticisms that her posture was too moderate, but it was surprising how well and how warmly she was welcomed in Miami.
And she has over 400,000 followers on Twitter, for those that who follow her, and she's translated into 20 different languages those words you spoke of. And this week she was also at the Herald in an interview with our Marva Hinton. Through a translator, she talked about the unity between Cubans here and Cubans there.
Pienso que el punto en común.
The main unity is that everybody, despite the differences in the beginnings and of the struggle, there is a unity, and everyone desires the same democracy.
It kind of really struck me when I heard, and she made the comments in the paper the next, about how similar Cubans in Havana are and how, you know, Cubans in Miami are. Did that surprise you, given the obviously wide disconnect between the two places?
Well, no, it wasn't surprising in a sort of a cultural and historic sense. There is, in fact, she pointed out that the exile community in Miami has, in fact, sort of maintained or recovered some of those aspects of Cuban life that were, in fact, lost on the island itself, such as, you know, recipes for food that, you know, are very difficult to find in Cuba, yet here in Miami, they persist. So in a sort of cultural and political terms, he was talking about a unity, and the surprising thing about her message was that it was how well received it was in this community.
And speaking of that message, she says that communication is beginning to change things in Cuba.
The internet, the voices in the internet are hammering away at the walls of the Cuban control, and they are opening little holes, and it is happening.
And as for how she's able to speak out and not be punished again through our translator.
They have harassed her, they have intimidated her, and what she tries to do is try to be a free person, and Twitter has protected her in doing that, so she thinks that's going to continue.
So Juan, what have they tried to do to her?
Well, they blocked access to her blog for from about 2007 to just a few months ago. If you were in Cuba, you could not access her blog. It's very difficult for her to sort of have access to the internet. She's been arrested a couple of times. There's been group demonstrations against her in Havana. The government regularly calls her a mercenary on the pay of the U.S. government and says she accepts U.S. government money to write her criticisms of Havana. She denies that flatly. She says she simply opposes the government of Cuba.
Now, she's obviously visited a lot of different places on this trip. Who else has she met with? She's been all over the United States. What was the other purpose of her visits here to the U.S.?
Well, you know, the government had prevented her, had denied her permission to leave Cuba 20 times in the last 12 years or so. So now she's gotten permission. She's obtained permission to leave the country. So she's been on a world tour. Part of it is picking up some of the awards that she had won over the last 10 years or so. And part of it is just getting her message out there. She's been in, Brazil, Mexico, the Czech Republic, Holland, New York, Washington, Mexico. I'm sure I'm missing some place.
And yeah, she's now been all over the place. Yeah.
Just today she turned up in Peru. So she's on a sort of a world tour, talking to a whole bunch of people. And getting her message out.
And one little final thing here quickly. She has an interesting view about the U.S. embargo on Cuba, which some people are trying to figure out.
Yeah, basically, you know, she says that the U.S. embargo is used by the Cuban government as an excuse for all of its failings. So if there's no bread on the line that morning in Havana, the government blames the embargo. And she says that is... not the way that relations should be. When it comes, however, to lifting the embargo, what needs to be done to lift the embargo? She has a much more nuanced approach to that question. At least I don't want to represent it. I've heard various versions of it, but she talks about the need to do things. While there is a discussion on how to lift the embargo.
Has she given her opinion on tourism to Cuba, whether she thinks people should be going there?
Again, the same thing. She believes she has criticized the U.S. restrictions on travel to Cuba, saying that if she defends the right of Cubans to travel abroad, she can do nothing less than defend the right of U.S. Citizens and residents to travel to Cuba. And again, there's this sort of, there is this sort of nuanced, exactly how to achieve that and what kinds of things do you require of those travelers. The answer is simple. Yes, she opposes U.S. travel restrictions, but there's a more sort of nuanced look behind it.
Juan Tamayo from El Nuevo Herald and the Miami Herald. Thanks very much for the insights this week on this story and the context.
Thank you.
All right. That was Brian Bendel, by the way, from the South Florida Business Journal. Patty Mazzei from the Miami Herald, also with us. And Alfred Spellman from Raconteur Film. So, Alfred, we talked about the tweets. And it's almost, we have a community of people that kind of know each other by Twitter, which have these tweets all around the world sort of broken down barriers. But especially in this case, with Yoani Sanchez, whether you understand Spanish or not, it's translated. But has that really made a huge difference? How much has the Twitter world made a difference here?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that the information age has given birth to this era of transparency that we're living in. And so, you know, whether you look at what she's managed to accomplish, you look at the Arab Spring, WikiLeaks, what the anonymous hacker collectives are able to do. You know, if you tell somebody from 50 years ago that you have a device in your pocket that could access, you know, all of the world's information ever known to man, and can now broadcast that to a worldwide audience, that combination of both access to knowledge as well as the ability to broadcast is a game changer.
All right, let's go to the phones. And we asked some folks this week for their comments, and we got a lot of good ones from Cubans and non-Cubans. First, we're going to go to Julieta, who is in South Miami. Do we have you? Yes, we do. Ma'am, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hello. A comment.
Yeah, how has she had any influence in the connection between the Cuban community here and in Cuba?
I'm sorry, that no influence in the Cuban community here?
Well, I was going to say, yeah, how has she influenced that connection between those here and those there?
All right. First, through communications, increased communications. I felt that Yoani served as a catalyst. And one thing that she supported and that she emphasized was the need for exiles to support communications inside Cuba and the willingness of exiles here to do so. That's the first time that I have ever seen it in my 12 years in Miami.
Great. All right, Julieta. Patty, do you want to talk about how she's maybe helped us to understand a little bit more about Cuban culture, just reading her tweets and her blogging?
Well, she came to the Miami Herald editorial board on Monday, actually got everyone out there at 8:30 in the morning, which is unusual.
Too early, as they said, este es temprano para Miami.
And when we asked her, like Julieta said, what should Cubans bring when they visit Cuba or others? And she said technology. I mean, you know, none of this like food or daily essentials, but phones and DVD players and tape recorders and things like that, which was fascinating, I think, for a lot of people to hear. To me, what was most impressive was she carries herself like somebody who really knows her way around people. I mean, this woman could run for office. You know, she's shaking everybody's hand, introducing themselves, looking them in the eye. She's very eloquent, very comfortable in the public eye, which is something I think until you see her in person, you might not realize.
Yeah, impressive lady, having met her this week. No question about that. Dina is in Coral Gables, and we welcome you to the Florida Roundup, Dina. So did her visit have any impact on your understanding of Cuba?
Yes. I'm not Cuban, but I went because I'm so impressed with her work and her message. And to me, it helped me better understand the longing for the Cuban community has here. I think, and what I felt at the event at Miami-Dade College was it was very important to connect to Cubans living here and acknowledging their pain of exile and their longing and their experience from someone living there.
All right. Well, Dina, thanks very much for your call. One more on this, and we'll go to Carlos, who's in Miami. Carlos, we welcome you to the Florida Roundup. And are you Cuban, Carlos?
Yes, I am Cuban. I want to thank you for having me on your show. I listen to it quite frequently.
My pleasure.
I was very, very impressed with her visit throughout the world, whether it was here in Miami to communicate with us directly, the victims of the genocide that CASA has carried out against us for the last 54 years, as well as to Latin Americans and Europeans so they can grope the scope of what's been going on there. And she describes so well, and a lot of non-believers, they have accused her of being a mercenary. So I think that she's in the right path. However, it's, like I said, the cat is out of the bag, and I wonder how long she's going to be tolerated until the government thinks it's time to shut her down.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Carlos. Thanks to all of our input from the Public Insight Network and for Juan Tamayo from Illinois Evo Herald for joining us to help us understand that. I want to remind you, it is your show, too, and we do have an online discussion that is happening as we speak online at our website, WLRN.org, where our shows are posted in their entirety. We can also be found on Facebook at the Florida Roundup and followed on Twitter at WLRN. We're going to try to use the hashtag TFR from now on for the Twitter world. We just talked about how important Twitter has been, and we certainly make it an important part of our show as well. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll shift to some state issues, talk about what's going on in Tallahassee. We also have some sports the public radio way later on in the show as the Marlins start and the Dolphin Stadium debate continues in just a moment. Hey, welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. With us, Alfred Spellman from Reckontor Films, Patty Mazzei from the Miami Herald, and Brian Bendel from the South Florida Business Journal. I'm Phil Latzman. As long as we're on the Twitter conversation, we all like to tweet. We all agree that it's become a key for any media person, anybody really, who does anything as far as reporting their own work or following people. So, Patty, give us your Twitter handle so they can follow you, and you do a lot of tweeting.
At Patricia Mazzei, M-A-Z-Z-E-I.
Brian Bandel, it's pretty easy. That's your Twitter handle, right? And spell it out.
Right. It's Brian with an I, Bandel, B-A-N-D-E-L-L. And if you want to find my work, you can also look me up on Amazon.
All right. And Alfred Spellman with the Reckontor Films, we know you do a prolific amount of tweeting, perhaps more than all of us combined.
And it's at Alfred Spellman, S-P-E-L-L-M-A-N.
I met Alfred on Twitter before I met him.
That's right. We've all met,
we've all met on Twitter
before we got here. At Phil Latzman is how you're going to find me. Now, we're going to move on to some state stuff. And we know, I love the Twitter handle Gina has. It's Hear My Thought, by the way. Gina Jordan is our WLRN Miami Herald News Tallahassee Bureau, one of our reporters there. Hi, Gina. Welcome back.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you back and to hear you. So the first thing we'll talk about this week in Tallahassee was the internet cafes. Many local seniors may not be happy about it, but both houses of the legislature have now passed the internet cafe ban. And those senior arcades have now been lumped in with that anti-gaming bill. Can you tell us more about what just happened yesterday concerning internet cafes?
Well, the Senate sponsor, John Thrasher, he says that any business that wasn't acting illegally before this bill won't have anything to worry about now. He said legitimate businesses will be able to stay open. Hmm. A couple of problems, though. The Florida Arcade Association says that the wording in the bill is going to affect possibly 200 or more arcades that are used by kids and senior citizens. It comes down to the wording. It involves arcade games need to use coins, for example. So some kids' arcades use prepaid cards. The other problem for these senior arcades is that some of these lawmakers really believe that gaming is going on inside those arcades, and they believe that those arcades should be shut down along with the internet cafes.
So the Florida Arcade and Bingo Association says there are approximately 10 senior arcades in Broward, 20 in Miami-Dade, and about 50 of them in Palm Beach County. Alfred, you were just talking about how much, and Brian talking about how everybody knows somebody that an older person that goes to these and spends a little bit of time and maybe not a lot of money actually at an internet cafe in South Florida.
Yeah, they put them right outside the retirement communities, right outside the Century Villages and the King's Points, and you know, to get suck up some of that Social Security money.
Here is 83-year-old Doris Gervolino of Boynton Beach. She says entertainment options would be sparse for her if these arcades classified as illegal are shut down.
I'm not a TV person. I'm not a movie person because I was always on the go, never sitting home watching TV like some people do, watching the soaps. I'm sick of the shopping centers. I am. I don't need new clothes anymore.
Fans of the arcade say the legislation went too far when it lumped the facilities together with internet cafes. They say arcade winners are rewarded with prizes like gift cards, not cash. Here's Bob Forrest, who is the former owner of two senior arcades at Cleopatra Arcade in Boynton Beach. He points out that the camaraderie between folks that attend.
This is where people come in to enjoy themselves. There's a lot of difficulty going on in the outside world. When you can come in here for a few hours, spend some time, meet your friends, have a good time, forget about the world's problems just for a couple hours, that's all we're trying to do.
But Gene, as we've heard, the Herald has done some investigation on this from Mary Ellen Kloss in the Tallahassee Bureau, and many others have found that there's some of these operators are a bit shady, and there's no requirement for background checks, and you really don't know the people that are running these places.
Exactly. I spoke with Mary Ellen Kloss about this, and she said that this is really pretty standard in the gaming industry. You want to do background checks to protect yourself. And it turns out a lot of these operators do have rap sheets, and so it really plays into what happened with the Allied Veterans Group, that group that now is facing racketeering and fraud charges. You really don't know who is operating these cafes.
And, Patty, how does this relate to the Macanitas? Are we talking about sort of the same things, the senior arcades in Palm Beach and the Macanitas in Miami?
Well, the Macanitas are the machines themselves rather than the place, you know, the Internet Cafe. But, you know, we just have a special name for it in Miami-Dade. And actually, it's an industry that's been around for a while. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that the Allied Veterans Group was operating in most counties in the state, if not all of them, except for Miami-Dade, because Miami-Dade has kind of its own separate crew of folks dealing with the machines.
And this has been a subject of major controversy in the city of Miami between the mayor and the former police chief. We remember that whole blow-up about a year ago, the former chief Miguel Exposito and the mayor Tomas Regalado about how to enforce these things.
Right, and the chief said they're illegal. The mayor said they're not. The former chief now says that he feels vindicated. But you still have that question. For example, the city of Hialeah also has some kind of municipal regulations that are not, you know, we're in that gray area of the law that this new legislation, which has just gone to the desk of the governor, is intended to clarify.
All right, now, and Gina, is the governor going to sign this bill? What's the deal? We've heard that he's planning on signing it, but what's the latest?
His spokeswoman yesterday said he will sign it. As soon as he gets it, he'll sign it.
All right. Now, moving on to another topic, and this is Medicaid expansion. Now, first of all, Brian Bendel, this is something at the South Florida Business Journal. You do a lot of coverage here. So just let's explain to people where things are right now with Medicaid expansion in the state of Florida.
Well, imagine the federal government comes to us with $53 billion. They're ready to give us over 10 years. And some people in state laws want to say, no, we don't want your money. In fact, we'll spend $15 million of our own money and create our own program. That is the logic of Senator Aaron Bean, a Republican. He wants to not only reject Medicaid expansion, he wants to do something called Health Choice Plus, where the state would fund $10 vouchers to buy health plans for people of lower income. I don't know how much of a health plan you could buy for $10, maybe 10% of a health plan or something like that, but that's his plan. Now, Joe Negron, the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, he wants to take the Medicaid money from the federal government and set up a Healthy Florida plan. This would be kind of like Florida Healthy Kids, but for adults. So they would use the
expand
share of the Medicaid dollar to buy you insurance. So you would get your own plan, and it would then expand eligibility up to people making 138% of poverty. Now, the problem is they can't agree on this plan. We're already halfway through the session, and time is running out. So they need to get their act together because there's $51 billion on the table here, and it may not be a good idea to just, you know, reject that money and let it all go away.
Now, the report out last week shows federal money to expand Medicaid would boost Florida's economy by 120,000 permanent jobs. This is based on the Florida Hospital Association, so there's a bit of a bias there. But here's UF economics professor Alan Hodges, who says the cost of not using the federal money for Medicaid expansion would be very high.
Fewer jobs here that will go somewhere else, and Florida will absolutely be a loser in that game.
So is that the general consensus up there, Gina, that they have to find a way to spend this money, and they've got about less than a month to figure out a way to do it?
Well, the consensus is that they have to come to an agreement of some sort. But Speaker Will Weatherford is adamant about not taking the federal money. So he really is sticking to his guns on that. Senate President Don Gates says we will come up with a solution in the next few weeks. So right now, I really don't know whether they would take the federal money.
Moving on to domestic partnerships, and before we even get into that, Florida Senator Bill Nelson has done an about-face on same-sex marriage. He was one of the lone Democrats holding out on his support. Now he says he supports gay marriage. He sent a statement to the editorial board of the Tampa Bay Times saying, quote, "The civil rights and responsibilities for one must pertain to all. Thus, to discriminate against one class and not another is wrong for me." Now, I guess the question is, Alfred, what took him so long? What was he worried about not running for re-election for a while? I guess that's...
You know, this issue is really kind of one of those things that obviously is dividing, along lines of age. And so, you know, I think we're seeing this slow transformation. If you look at the polling back from 04, the 04 election, we all remember this was a hot issue and it had divided a lot of places, divided Ohio in the presidential election.
Right.
And I think we're kind of seeing a changing of the guard now as kind of the older generation is ushered off the stage. I think the tea leaves are, being read and politicians are realizing that this is the way we're headed. And I think the other issue, the medical marijuana bill in Tallahassee, is also kind of along the same lines. I think we're going to see some evolution on both these issues.
We're going to devote a couple of minutes to that. Of course, the director, one of the creators of Square Grouper, would want to get your way on that in just a moment. But the domestic partnerships, now, aside from gay marriage, domestic partnerships, this week what was described as historic legislation on domestic partnerships actually made its way through the Florida Senate. What's the story with that, Gina? Is there hope that domestic partnership bill might actually pass in Florida one of these days?
One of these days. I don't think it will happen this session. It is the first time that any Florida legislative committee has approved a domestic partnership registry idea. So it passed the committee 5-4. One Republican, Senator Nancy Dietert, crossed lines and voted yes. So this was a big deal, but there are no more hearings scheduled for this bill during this session. And even Senator Sobel, who's one of the sponsors, she said that she does not think this will pass this year.
Gay rights advocates say, though, it does mark the first time the Florida legislature has ever voted to recognize same-sex relationships. Now, here's another thing, as Alfred just mentioned, that might or may not change in Florida. Legalization of medical marijuana bills have been proposed, but if you'll excuse the pun, quickly gone up in smoke. The sponsor of a bill to legalize medical marijuana in Florida estimates its chances of passage is slim to none. But Representative Katie Edwards said the idea will be back as a constitutional amendment, possibly, on next year's ballot. She supports access to pot for severely ailing Floridians, not for recreational use.
If you would have asked me about 6 months ago when we were campaigning, would I have filed this bill? I would have said absolutely not. And I got sick myself in the hospital talking with other cancer patients and people who themselves were very sick.
So we hear these stories all the time. We make fun of pot usage. I don't think you're going to be smoking, anybody's going to be smoking joints on the streets of South Florida anytime soon, Alfred. But certainly sounds like a little bit different tone than we've heard before there.
Tallahassee, where tomorrow is yesterday, still apparently, when it comes to medical marijuana and domestic partnerships. You know, you look at the polling on legalization of marijuana, and the latest national poll shows for the first time that a majority of Americans approve of it. And I think we're dealing with the same political gridlock we see on gun control in the Senate right now in the U.S. Senate, where you have a 90-10 split, people in favor, and you can't get the legislators to act. And I think that we're seeing that here, on a state level, where there's more and more support for both these items, and you're seeing just gridlock and a failure to act.
And the bill was named for a woman named Kathy Jordan, who was up trying to get it passed. She's in a wheelchair. She has ALS, known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and says marijuana has kept her alive since her diagnosis in 1986. But again, little chance of passage there. Gina, what else is on the radar before we say goodbye to you in Tallahassee that we look forward to for next week?
Well, one of the big things that passed this week was the parent trigger bill that passed in the House.
Mm-hmm.
That still has to go before the Senate. But you may recall, this is the bill that gives parents a say in how the school board should make changes to a failing school. This was a big deal last year. It passed the House last year, got down to the last day of session, and failed in a tie vote in the Senate. So it has passed the House again. We'll see what happens next with the Senate.
Right, Gina Jordan is our reporter in Tallahassee for WLRN Miami Herald News. One of them, Rick Stone, of course, up there as well. You guys doing a great job covering Tallahassee for us this session. Gina, thanks as always.
Thank you, Phil.
All right. And back out, I'm interested to hear Patty Mazzei covering Miami-Dade County. We'll talk about the Dolphins situation in just a little bit, and you're right on top of that. But what are people in Miami-Dade County, the state's largest county, the largest donor county, the county that always feels like it's sort of being picked on when it comes to Tallahassee, what are they saying about what's gone on so far in the first month?
Well, I've heard a lot of concern about the living wage legislation that's going. Actually, I think the House may have approved it yesterday, which would force the county to do away with its local living wage ordinance that requires a higher minimum wage than elsewhere in the state. The argument is from Tallahassee is that there's a patchwork, that there's not some kind of uniformity across the state. The argument from Miami-Dade is we have home rule, and if we want to pay people more, we can do it, get out of our way, you know. But,
right, the cost of living is a lot more in Miami-Dade County than it is in Leon County.
Yeah, but it's looking, you know, there's a law that's being discussed in Orlando, and so in targeting that law, they're going to probably force the county to change its weights. But the Senate has a whole different plan, so we'll see where that goes.
And, Brian, on the issue of citizens' property insurance, which you are perhaps the preeminent expert on that. We've talked a lot about this on the show with you in the past. We have a confirmation hearing for the Citizens Chairman and some changes of coverage that Citizens is going to consider the state-run insurer. Still with 1.3 million Floridians on its in its ranks. What's the latest with reforms at Citizens?
Well, the South Florida property market is red hot, but some of the changes on Citizens could be like a wet blanket there. Some of the changes include they could raise rates higher than 10% annually for new customers. You couldn't choose Citizens if a private insurer would give you a rate within 15%. And also, very important for people with higher-end homes, they would limit the amount of coverage from Citizens to $500,000 after 5 years. Currently, it's $2 million. And then they would also not cover new construction along the coast. Are you hearing this, condo developers? Mm. No new construction along the coast covered. So that would be a big problem for a lot of people, and a lot of the real estate brokers I talked to are concerned about that. But why would they do this? Well, the issue is Citizens can cover what would normally happen, but Citizens doesn't have enough money to cover a 1-in-100-year storm. If that happened, it would run out of money. It would have to assess
everyone. That's what
everyone. They say. I mean, that's the report
that's
show.
That's actuarially sound.
That's true, but we also have to remember, that means there's a 1% chance every year that happens. So for a 1% chance every year, we will take these dramatic steps. So it has to be kind of, you know, what is the risk? Is the risk of 1% a year that great that we have to take all of these steps and do all these things that might hurt the real estate market, or we just try and tough it out for a few more years?
Well, and the other thing is people are going to start getting their private insurance bills now. I think I just paid my last Citizens bill. Now people are going to start getting they're going to come, the people that have been transferred off of Citizens and back onto private insurance, what's going to happen now? They're going to start getting their bills from these private insurers, and they don't know how much they're going to be paying, right?
Well, the first thing you're going to see when you get the private insurer bill is a much higher rate, because they are not limited as Citizens is. Citizens is limited how much they can raise your rate. The private insurer is not. So once they'll get you, and then the next time they send you that bill, it'll be much higher, and you'll have to decide whether you can afford it or where else you can go. A lot of times you may not find anyone else.
Well, can't wait for that bill to come in the mail. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. That is Brian Bandel of the South Florida Business Journal. Also with us is Alfred Spellman, documentarian and co-founder of Raconteur Films, and Patricia Mazzei, the Miami-Dade reporter and plenty of other politics for the Miami Herald. We're going to take a break. I'm Phil Latzman. We're back. We're talking sports and stadiums in just a moment. I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN with our guests, Patricia Mazzei of the Miami Herald, Alfred Spellman from Raconteur Films, Brian Bandel from the South Florida Business Journal. We do have our online discussion taking place on our website, WLRN.org. Our shows are also posted there in their entirety when we complete them, or sometime in the afternoon, over the weekend. We can also be found on Facebook at the Florida Roundup and followed on Twitter at WLRN. We're going to try to use the hashtag TFR and sort of get used to using that for our Twitter feed. Now, moving on to the world of sports, as we covered in a public radio way here, never in their 20 years as a franchise have the Marlins been more reviled or more ignored. The ball club has started its season 0-3, managing just one run in those first three games. They were swept by the Nationals in their opening series in Washington. They'll try for their first win of the season in New York against the Mets tonight and this weekend, but the real scrutiny will come next week when the team will begin season number 2 in their new ballpark, and tickets, as they say, are still available and plentiful after the 2012 season, which left many baseball fans scratching their heads in the purge and the new stadium. As part of our foul ball special here on WLRN this week, Marlins president David Sampson said, mistakes, yeah, we made a few.
all I can continue to say is I'm sorry it all happened like it did. I guess a lot of me wishes we had a $70 million payroll last year and a $70 million payroll this year instead of 100 last year and 40 this year. I think maybe you'd have a different show today. But that said, you can't change the past, and we went all in, which is what we said at the time, and it just didn't work on myriad levels.
Alfred Spellman, you have eyebrows raised as a huge baseball fan there. Respond to that.
Well, you know, David Sampson had his own 47% video come out last year before the season even started. He was speaking at the Beacon Council last March, and in describing his dealings with discussing moving the Marlins to Las Vegas, he apparently or said that he told the mayor, he said, we don't care if anybody comes. We'll play in front of nobody and we'll have all the money. And so, you know, he admitted to letting the team bottom out. You know, Loria and Sampson did the same thing in Montreal to the Montreal Expos to win what they've done to this community. It's an outrage. And I think the Dolphins are now dealing with a lot of the blowback from that from the Marlins Stadium deal. Never has there been a bigger boondoggle of a stadium deal than Marlins Stadium.
So also on the show is Norman Brayman, who is the man, the billionaire crying wolf, if you will, after the stadium deal went through, was behind the successful effort to recall Miami-Dade's Mayor Carlos Alvarez and Commissioner Natasha Cejas. He also tried to oust other local officials who supported the deal. As much as he hated it, he says he does not blame the Marlins.
What the Marlins basically did is what just about every sports team, whether it's the National Football League or whether it's Major League Baseball, tries to get the taxpayers to pick up the tab and of their venue. My fault is not with the Marlins. My fault is with the politicians of these communities that allow these travesties to happen.
So Patty Mazzei, covering the Miami-Dade Commission, which was responsible for funding most of this ballpark, how much buyer's remorse is there with the way things have gone with the Marlins right now?
Not that much. I mean, the folks who Brayman targeted last year to try to oust the incumbents all won re-election, in part thanks to some of the support they got from the Marlins and the Dolphins. And, you know, you have Commissioner Dennis Moss, who has called Brayman a bully. And so, you know, have they said we wish we had known more of the Marlins' finances? Sure. But this time around with the Dolphins, they certainly tried to go about things a little bit differently. And they asked Mayor Carlos Jimenez to try to negotiate something with the team that would benefit the county so as to avoid a similar debacle. But we'll see. We'll see where it ends up.
I thought Rick Haro, who hosted the show here on Monday, summed things up well. I'll paraphrase it, saying basically this is nothing new, Alfred, that these deals get done all the time, and we look around the country. But the teams don't drop the ball, if you will, like the Marlins, or the commitment to making a winner. Let's hear what he said, because I'm not paraphrasing it well. I want you to respond to this.
Successful public-private partnership deals are grounded on a firm belief in a common future, civic pride, and the value of a sports franchise. But in the final analysis, the Marlins deal lacks those hallmarks. And while the financial deal between the Marlins and the local community is, I believe, well within the range of acceptable business terms, the behavior and commitment from the Marlins ownership is not.
That sums things up for you?
Well, you know, we were talking earlier about Mickey Arison and the Miami Heat. The Miami New Times has done some reporting on the contract between the Heat and the county in terms of the amount of rent that the Heat is supposed to pay, mm-hmm. and whether they've been paying it. And
if any at all.
If any at all. But at the same time, Mickey Arison's put a winning team on the court. And, you know, and I think we've all enjoyed the Heat winning streak this year and the world championship. And so, you know,
But they've been consistent.
Exactly. And you know, you have, with Sampson, with Loria and Sampson in Marlins Park here, we basically got about 3 months of a team before it began starting to get dismantled.
He just admitted that. That they made a huge mistake by spending $140 million and then $40 million. Well, I mean, how do you trust people to run your franchise that make those kind of mistakes?
That's a good question.
But what kills me is this whole stadium, when they were talking about it, they were saying, oh, this would really boost Little Havana. All these businesses will come here and there will be development. It hasn't boosted them at all. I mean, there are no companies have leased in that parking garage where they're supposed to have retail tenants. There's no development around the stadium. And now the stadium's going to be mostly empty, so it's not going to bring people to the area. It's just a bunch of broken promises. It's just going to be there as a gigantic reminder of the mistake we've made.
Yeah, like the Miami Arena, as Alfred and I talked about before the show, and that was supposed to be this great thing for downtown Miami, which never happened either. Patty Mazzei, though, you have been for the last few weeks and months now following this story with the Miami Dolphins, and this is obviously interconnected, their push to get taxpayers to pitch in for stadium renovations. What's the latest there? I know there are new developments.
I think when you say they're interconnected, that's to the Dolphins' great chagrin, because the last thing they want to do is be seen as the Marlins. The Dolphins have parallel routes to try to get public funding to renovate Sun Life Stadium. One is through the state. They need to get legislation passed there for a sales tax rebate and to allow Dade County to increase its mainland hotel taxes. And then while they're doing that, they're trying to get a deal with Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez on how those hotel taxes would be spent. And then that deal would have to be approved by county commissioners, who would then have to put it on the ballot, because they've all said they want to go to a referendum on May 14th. Tick-tock, the days are running out.
So going to happen or it's not going to happen?
Well, they were...
Jimenez, and how many people will actually know if it does happen?
Jimenez and the Dolphins were negotiating yesterday. They met at 3 p.m. The meeting got out like at 1 a.m. this morning. They may continue talking today and through the weekend. We were hearing that there could be a potential special commission meeting next Tuesday. But, you know, this is all very down to the wire. How is this going to work out? How much time are people going to have to digest everything? So we'll see.
All right. We asked our great folks with the Public Insight Network. And by the way, if you want to contribute to this show, WLRN.org/insight, our informed army of pinheads, as we call them, Public Insight Network folks have contributed as well to the show. And let's go to one of them. Terry is in Miami Lakes. And welcome to the discussion on the Florida Roundup. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So tell me how you stand as far as what you've just heard in this conversation and stadiums and the future of what's going on here.
Well, no, I think one of your previous comments in there about the fact the expectation that Marlins Stadium was going to bring about a renewal and revival in the Little Havana area, I've been just kind of curious why it is. I mean, with that stadium having a covered roof, it seems to be an ideal location for concerts, for venues. I would have expected some major shows to be booked into Marlins Stadium so that you could have continuous activity year-round.
Mm-hmm.
And then, to my knowledge, I don't think there's been one concert booked into the Marlins Stadium since the project's been completed.
Well, Brian?
Yeah, they attempted to have one, like a world music concert they were advertising for this summer, but they canceled it and basically no one was going to show up. The Marlins haven't really done much of a job promoting other events in that venue. I'm not sure if it's the configuration or what, but they just haven't been successful. And so, unfortunately, it hasn't brought people down there. It hasn't been a lot of economic development for it. And that's the problem, because there was supposed to be this great thing that would benefit the community and revitalize Little Havana. And they just haven't brought anyone there. And now, this year, it's just going to be empty with only a few people coming to that area.
And as I understand it, they would get a lot of the revenue if the way the deal is structured at Alfred, if they did that.
I think a flea market or a swap meet might attract more people than a Marlins game this year.
Terry, thanks very much for your call. Moving on to who else we have here. Todd is in Miami Springs. Hi, Todd. Welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hi, Phil. My problem with the Dolphin Stadium issue is they seem to be playing on this notion of civic pride and skipping the dollars and cents. I mean, I haven't seen them submit real verifiable numbers that would show that this is truly a straight investment that the community would benefit from. They haven't shown any real numbers. It's all pie in the sky stuff.
Yeah, Alfred.
Well, because you can't get any respectable economist to say that investing in sports stadiums spurs economic development. In fact, State Senator Tom Lee, a Republican from Brandon, was quoted as saying, "I don't believe sports stadiums are economic development, but if we're going to do it, it should be equitable." And so now we're crafting a bill, apparently in Tallahassee, to give other communities an equal shot at obtaining public money. I think my biggest objection here is that there seems to be now a presumption that sports franchises are somehow entitled to public money. The question is just how much should they get or what type of deal should we craft, rather than is the question of publicly financing these venues a priority for the state or the community?
Well, the Dolphins have said that the economic development is what the community gets from, especially the major events, the Super Bowls, the college football championships. And, PolitiFact Florida, I think, was on the case at one point because the Dolphins lobbyist made a claim about like $500 million in economic development. I don't think anybody thinks that's the real number. Certainly the county has said we think there is some benefit from those large events. But, let's kind of tread carefully here. And see if that's enough to justify the public benefit at this the public investment at this point.
And one more on the topic from Sid, who is in South Miami. Sid, we welcome you to the program.
Okay, thank you.
Has anything with the Dolphins' recent concessions changed your mind about public funding for stadium renovations?
Well, actually, it would if they put revenue sharing on the table. And I'm a little confused to why revenue sharing in terms of concessions, television profits, ticket sales, and things like that are not shared with the community. It puts up money up front.
I think that's a good point because a part of the stadium plan is to move 3,600 seats closer to the field. And so that would be more money for them. They'll be able to charge a lot more for that.
Right.
So the question I haven't seen answered is how much money will the Dolphins make by having those better seats? And can the public share in that? Or is it possible that upgrading those seats might pay for itself?
Yeah, that's certainly that seems like a lot of revenue you could get by expanding that stadium in that way. I guess the question is, at what point, and maybe you have a perspective on this, Patty, but does Stephen Ross perhaps say, look, I'm worth a few billion dollars here? I mean, does he ever come out and just say, I'm going to write a check for $400 million, just end it, become a huge hero, everybody's a Dolphin fan, or this fight continues and they get as much public money as possible?
Well, I think that's unlikely at this point, just because you would think they would have made that calculation from the beginning if that was where things were going to end up. You know, their line has been, well, if the community gets benefit from these large events that we have, and we're not the Marlins, we have kind of a longer history in this community, people feel more involved with the Dolphins, then the community should have, money and skin in the game. Like Alfred said, it's a bit of a philosophical question from people who say, no, we shouldn't give these people any money, to people who say, well, is there some benefit that we can gain from joining them as partners here?
Well, and I think one of the other questions is also, what are the alternative uses of this money? I mean, the study of economics is about scarce resources, and so what else could this money be spent on if it's not being spent on the Dolphins stadium renovation?
Well, we could go on, and probably we'd need another hour. It sounds like Brian Bandel, before we go, what are you working on that we can read about and hear about?
Well, I'm writing in the South Florida Business Journal and have all kinds of great reports on bank mergers and acquisitions, issues with health care. I'll be covering Medicaid reform going forward. And I'm also a writer with Silverleaf Books, so if you want to check out my novel Mute, hear about some of the spooky mysteries in Florida, you can do that at Silverleaf Books or look me up on Amazon.
He's a business writer and a fiction writer at the same time, and maybe all those things can get together one day. And Alfred, you've got Raconteur Films, you and Billy working on some stuff. What's up?
We got a couple of documentaries coming out this year. Dogfight's our next release about the backyard fighting circuit and down in Perrine. You can check that out at raconteur.com.
And what about the UM investigation? Well, UM has very quickly said they call on NCAA to dismiss the case. Do you think that's realistic against them? We have the booster scandal.
I don't think it's realistic, but I think it's just.
And what about you, Patty, as a UM alum? You get the last word here. What are you working on?
Well, I don't have any cool fiction books or documentaries coming out, but daily beat coverage of Miami-Dade government and politics, which is never boring.
And so much fun. And if you have a poem on that, by the way, we'd like to hear about it, because it's Poetry Month here
in Miami.
How'd you like that one, huh? If you got a poetry, if you got a poem on Miami-Dade or anything, we have this That's So Miami Poetry Project. Please go to WLRN.org and look at it and submit your poem. We might read it on the air. That does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, April 5th, 2013. Thanks to our great panelists. If you missed any of the show, we have it back on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. We also post it at WLRN.org. Produced by Alicia Zuckerman. Thanks to Elaine Chen, our associate producer who puts it together every week. Our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow, and our social media editor, Danny Rivera. Our executive producer for WLRN, Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. Until next week, I'm Phil Latzman. Thanks for listening. Stay informed, South Florida.